Okay, so today we are fortunate to have Louise Novotny as our interview subject. Louise is at her home in Washington, D.C. Is that right? And Debbie is at home in D.C. as well, I presume. And Hannah, looks like you're back in Brooklyn. And I'm Jeff Reckenbach here in Cleveland. So, Louise, the way we like to start these
You
is
want to say
just
the date, Jeff?
Oh, sure. Today is May 23rd, 2024. A lovely Thursday afternoon in Cleveland, Ohio. So the way we like to start these is just learn a little bit about your growing up, just to get some of your background before you came into the labor movement. So let's start at the very, very beginning. Where and when were you born?
I was born in Albuquerque, New Mexico in 1953 to my father, who was in the Air Force stationed at White Sands Air Force Base there, working on rockets. and my mother, Peggy, who was, at the time she was not a nurse, but she had been a nurse and an army nurse at that. So that's where, that's where I was born. That's where our families, from my point of view, started. We moved to Patrick Air Force Base, Florida, which was attached to Cape Canaveral. And Dad, at White Sands, it was small rockets. At Cape Canaveral, big rockets. And he was the head of the Titan missile program there. That at that time it was an ICBM. So this was, I was born in 53. We moved to Patrick in 58. So it was the beginning of the Cold War, and we were arming up. The U.S. was arming up, and he was part of that. What was going on that front? And at the same time, we were beginning the space race. And so rockets were being, changed to, instead of just going, preventing war or preventing rockets from reaching us, also going up into space and shooting men into space. And while we were there, I saw Alan Shepard, Scott Carpenter, John Glenn, and Gus Grissom being launched up into space. And it was a great place to grow up. We lived like a block from the beach. We could run out our front door and see the rockets going up. And before even those guys got up into space, because it was, this Cold War time and they were developing rockets, there were lots of rockets going off. I at one time looked up. There was at least one rocket every day for the period that we lived there. At least one. Sometimes there were more. There were Minutemen, there were Snarks, there was Dad's rocket, which was the Titan. It was the biggest rocket on the Cape at that time, which we were very proud of. And then that's the rocket that became the booster for the Gemini astronauts. It because it it they needed more power. They had to be bigger, power more powerful rockets than the Mercury, because they were going out of the atmosphere to orbit the moon. So they needed, and so those, big, powerful, noisy rockets. But anyway, it was, as I say, it was a great place to grow up, and it was very, everybody in our neighborhood, all the dads worked on rockets. That's what life was. And because it was this developmental stage, there was this real camaraderie. And also we were very isolated at that time. That area was, just, there was nothing there. Just the Air Force Base and the rocket center. But at any rate, when families would get together, the dads would all be talking about, yeah, we missed that launch because of this, and they'd be collaborating about how to fix things. have you tried this? Have you tried that? It was a real sense of collegiality and problem solving and mission that was fostered there.
Wow.
I always get sentimental when
Yeah,
I
I'm
think
sure.
about those days.
I'm
So,
sure.
but at any rate, that was sort of how we saw people operating.
Yeah.
And I think the kids carried that forward, my brother and sister and I. Have that sort of sense of how we move in the world, that we're problem solvers, we're collaborators.
Yeah, right.
And that was our values. Other values, my dad was very conservative. My mother, at that point in time, she felt she did what, she thought what dad thought, in terms of politics and that sort of thing, but she grew out of that over time. But there was no connection to the labor movement. And in fact, when I did start working for CWA many late years later, my dad took me aside to warn me about the labor unions. And my mother told me, he said, she won't last a year there. Any rate, so he I think he had this vision of, rough and tough, guys that I wouldn't acclimate to, but he was wrong.
Thankfully.
For me too.
Yeah. So, I have to go back to White Sands for a minute.
Oh,
Did you ever go sled riding down the dunes?
I was born there. We left when I was
Five.
five.
Yeah.
I have a very thin memory of my time there, to be honest.
Okay.
I remember things like chopping down Christmas trees in the what are those mountains called?
Yeah.
I can't. Anyway, but that yeah,
Yeah.
very, very,
Yeah.
very
Yeah.
few
Yeah.
memories, frankly.
So, where are you in the pecking order between your brother and sister?
I'm the middle kid.
Okay, middle kid. So, you moved to Florida when you're 5 years old. I presume that's where you started school.
Yes.
Okay, what
Yes.
public school or
Yes. At the
on the
time, it
base,
was
I
a school
guess?
on the base. Yeah. And we moved up here in 62.
Okay.
So, and dad got promoted. He was now, he became, I'm going to call it a lobbyist. There's probably a different name for it, but he was connected to the Strategic Air Command. And a lot of his job was going to the Hill to brief members of Congress about our rocket programs and try to make sure they were well funded.
So, did you live in the district or Virginia or
No,
Maryland?
we lived in Prince George's County,
Okay.
near he was stationed at Andrews Air Force Base right outside
Okay.
of D.C.
And where did you go to school there?
I went to high school at Crossland High School. It was the first high school, or it was fairly new when I went. And it was sort of this a landmark. I don't know. It was they built it to be, it was unique at the time. It was had a vocational wing as well as what we'll call the traditional sort of college prep wing. So there were some core classes that people went to together, English, math, blah, blah. But then kids who wanted to go into automotive mechanics, to carpentry, to electricity, went off to the, and also cosmetology. I forget all the programs, but there were quite a few, and they went off into that wing. And those of us who had ambitions to go to college stayed in the other wing. It was an interesting mix of kids at the time. And again, because we were not on the base at this time, this was the first time When we moved up to Maryland, the first time I ran into people who didn't who weren't associated with the Air Force. And I it but to be honest, I was it was an embarrassing awakening for me. I'm going on too much.
No, please. This is why this is.
I remember going to the bus stop first day of school, and Jeff, like you, I'm shy person and have always been. Yeah, you were describing me when you were describing yourself, but he
Also born in 1953, by the way. So,
maybe you are.
yeah.
I went to the bus stop and tried to, my mother's encouraged me to make friends. She thinks I'm too close to my brother because, he and I were great pals. And he says, "You need to meet new friends. Go meet new friends." And anyway, I go up to this little girl who looks to be my age and ask her, "So, what rocket does your dad work on?" She looks at me like, "My dad doesn't work on a rocket." And I was like, "Oh, okay. So is he in, is he working in the Air Force?" I don't remember exactly. She's like, "Oh, my dad owns a hardware store." And I'm like, "Whoa." This is like poof. So I got to meet a whole new world.
Just as an aside, I grew up in an all-Catholic neighborhood,
Oh.
and I was Lutheran, and I was hanging out with my buddies, and, "Why aren't you Catholic? What religion are you?" I had no idea what religion I was, no clue. And they said, "Well, are you Jewish?" And I thought, and I said, "Well, I have heard in church that Jesus was the king of the Jews. So, yeah, I guess I'm Jewish." And I went home that night. I said, "Mom, how come we're Jewish and everybody else in the neighborhood's Catholic? Where'd you hear we're Jewish?" "Well,
Made some
we're not
assumptions.
Catholic. We must be Jewish. We're Lutheran. It's your father's thing. He's the Lutheran. I'm the Catholic here."
That's a good
So it was a
one.
big thing between them. But yeah, same kind of story. It's like,
Yeah, this
I just didn't fit in. But
no,
any rate, so you mentioned your brother. Was he older or younger than you?
he's a year older, and my sister is a
Okay.
year younger. We were just bing, bing, bing.
Yeah. So he kind of had you under his wing a little bit. Is that the
Yeah, he was always he was very he was the leader of the pack. Our he has two sisters who to this day adore him and think he's like, the most wonderful guy. But he always looked out for us.
Yeah. So after high school, where do you go now?
Can I
No, go
ask
ahead.
one question about high school? At this time, Prince George's County, some parts are becoming more African American, and there's some desegregation of the schools going on. Is that happening in Camp
That
Springs?
not th that it didn't happen at that time in Prince George's County. It happened later. It happened, for example, I think the desegregation program actually started when my sister, I had graduated, and my sister was still in high school, but busing. At the time, honestly, at the time I was going to school there, there were maybe three black families in the radio. It was not a lot. And then they started busing, but it was after I was there.
So college is next.
Right. Well,
So
and
where'd you
that I
go?
would say, so I graduated in 71. I assume Jeff, like you. And but at the time in the high school, there were a lot of activists, shall we say, and we had demonstrations, anti-war demonstrations, that was kind of a weird thing to be in a military family, and a dad who is making, is responsible for making ICBMs. Being anti-war, but my brother was at risk, as were many friends, and so we th there were these demonstrations at the high school, and then when I went to college, there was still some residual demonstration. It wasn't the passion of the 68, 69 kind of, but we still had at the University of Maryland, it was like a spring ritual, taking over Route 1 that went through College Park. And these huge demonstrations there. And that is where I started. I think at those demonstrations where I got this sense of the power of the collective, and in addition, the atmosphere at that time in those demonstrations was, we can change the world. And when the war ended, we thought we did change the world, right? And so it was very inspirational, and it had that same sort of aphrodisiac that being at Cape Canaveral did, right? That, we're sort of on this brink of making change. We're sort of on the brink of making history, and it had that same sort of energizing feel about it at that time.
But by the way, I had the same dichotomy. My father worked at the Cadillac plant. It was a Cadillac plant that made tanks. So
Oh,
here I
no
am
kidding.
demonstrating against the war, and
Right.
he's at a plant that manufactures tanks for the war. So,
Oh my gosh. And
it
one of
was.
the things I learned from Jeff's interview was he was at Kent State. I think it was, you said, the day before the four people were
The
shot.
weekend before. So that I
Wow.
was still in high school. So we would go down. Kent was like the nearest college campus where there was
Stuff.
protests going on. And so me and a buddy of mine drove down to Kent, spent the weekend down there demonstrating, and the students were shot, I think, on Tuesday. So Tuesday or Wednesday, it was later on the week. We were back in Cleveland, back in high school at that point. So, but
Wow.
yeah, so it was kind of a hotbed for activity around the area.
I went to a few years ago, went to Kent State. There, David Crosby was performing there, and some little dive place in and so I walked around the campus, and I was so impressed how they have really. They've created a memorial. You can walk around the campus, and it's got placards telling you what happened at what time. And there's a little museum that I think is really, really captures the time and the atmosphere of what happened there very well. It was really powerful.
It's a very nice campus. I mean,
Beautiful too.
So you're at the University of Maryland. What's your course of study?
I majored in English. I didn't start with that. I started be something practical. This was my dad was insisting that I couldn't, I fancied myself, a writer and an, scholar. I don't know what, but so I think I started in journalism, and at one point, I didn't pass the typing test. And I stormed out and found something else to do, and I majored in education for a while, and then I finally just went with my passion and got into English. And wow, I haven't really thought about this in a while, but I became the I was got jobs in the English department. I was a tutor at one point, helping kids who sort of couldn't even make the grade in the freshman English, and then got hired to be the assistant to the chairman of the department. And my job was to do research for her. She was a specialist in restoration comedy, which was not my cup of tea.
What is restoration comedy?
I
What?
know, yeah, I don't even remember, but it's, you could think of white, wigs and fancy dress and silliness. But my other job was to review all of the resumes that came in. This is about, I've skipped ahead. This is in graduate school when I was
Okay. Yeah, I was going to ask you that question.
yeah, this was and review the resumes and assess which ones were in categories that we needed and pass them on to the hiring committee to see. And these resumes came in by the bagfuls. It was astounding to me. And the time I spent reviewing resumes and making judgment on these people, and to say it just got to me. And I saw my own resume passing through there, going, oh, we don't need her. Anyway, this is kind of embarrassing, but here's what I did one day. I came in, having been at the library doing research for her all day, big barrel full of resumes sitting on my desk. I sat down in a chair and I took, it was a big, basket kind of thing. I went and just threw it across my little cubby hole. And the ones that I could pick up without getting out of my chair are the ones that got passed on. And I, the next day, quit. I was like, or I didn't immediately quit, but I was like, I'm not going to continue with this. I need to get out in the real world, and I don't want to be in this batch of resumes that I just rejected. And anyway, I did a number of jobs before I then ran into my parents' across the street neighbor, Rudy Mendoza, who was the national director of independent telephone at CWA. And he was looking for somebody to be an administrator for this little pension fund that he was chair of, the Labor Management Pension Fund. And they just needed, someone to be an administrator. But in addition, the ERISA had just recently been enacted, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, and they were required to produce a summary plan description. The law required all plans to have a easily understandable summary plan description. It was the first, other than these legalese kind of documents that were otherwise the only thing available. He said, why don't you come work for me? And I think we both thought it would be, sort of a short-term thing. He'd get his problem taken care of. I would have a job. But I really liked working for the union. I really liked, again, there was this air of change, making things happen, of solving problems, of working collaboratively, and so I stuck around for another 40 years.
Very cool. So,
That's right.
what year is that then? That's going
Oh,
to be 76,
77.
77? Okay.
77, I started with the Labor Management Pension Fund.
And so you were housed at K Street? Is that was there an
Yes,
office there?
exactly. Yeah,
Okay.
1925 K Street.
Okay. Okay. Very cool.
Yeah.
Let me, before I hand this over to Debbie to talk about your CWA career, let me dial back for a minute and ask, when you were engaged. Was your brother engaged in protests against the war as well?
Yes,
Okay.
yes,
And
yes.
so what was your parents' reaction to your,
Oh my gosh.
yeah.
They were split up too. My dad was furious. My dad, he couldn't, we couldn't talk civilly about it, what was going on. My mother was torn up because she didn't want her boy going to Vietnam. And she even later confessed to me that she was making plans about sending him to Canada because we had relatives in Canada. But yeah, it was not.
Yeah.
How about, well, now I'm asking you, how about in your family?
Actually, my father, it was kind of benign. My father was a Republican, a Nixon Republican. I mean, really grew up in a family that was a Teddy Roosevelt Republican and just kind of stayed with it, you know. But really never was angry about my protest against my mother was deathly against the war. And I think it was both. I was the oldest, and I think in both cases it was they didn't want to see me shipped overseas, so they sort of understood it and didn't. I have to say they really didn't give me any trouble for it. I mean, they knew I went down to Kent to protest against it, and
Oh wow, okay. Okay.
so as long as I had a decent haircut, I was allowed.
I think that's part of my dad's problem too. My brother, had the long hair. But my dad, he was Charlie was selected to go to the Air Force Academy. And went through all the stuff you have to do, the interviews, the what re recommendations, and then when the time came, he said, "I'm not going." And that I think that's where the rift really started. And yeah, it was not, especially for my brother, it was very tough. And my dad, well, we had other issues with dad, but. But yeah, I don't think he ever quite got over that.
That's too bad. Okay, you're in 1925 K Street, so I will turn it over to my partner, Debbie, to talk about your CWA career. I may chip in every now and then, so
Please do. Yes.
Please do. Louise, let's just get it very quickly. The first, from 77 to 83, until you started in the research department. So just you don't have to tell too much detail, but you've told us you were the administrator for the Labor Management Pension Fund. And by the way, you said Rudy Mendoza was the director of the Independent Telephone Group. And I don't think in any of our interviews yet we've talked about the Independent Telephone Group. So very briefly, most of the people we've interviewed who come out of the telephone side came out of the Bell system.
Yeah, he was. So he came out of General Telephone out of Southern California. Dina Beaumont. Well, she was at General, but they were different unions or locals, I think. But at any rate, gosh, I don't remember them all. What was there?
Well, just in general, what it was the non-Bell
These were the
systems.
non-Bell telephone companies. They tended to be smaller companies, and a lot of them in the sort of rural areas. I'm trying to remember what was there is I can't
Well,
remember these.
the predecessors to what became Centel and Sprint, but I think one of the main things is that there was not a national contract or even a regional contract. These, except for a few of the general telephone units, were relatively big, but most of the others were pretty small.
They were small units, and you're right. They each had their own contracts. Rudy was not did not negotiate the contracts, but was often brought in to assist, and then also was considered like a clearinghouse. So he had a research assistant, John Howard, who you may remember, but who gathered information so that all the units would have a library, if you will, of information about the key issues and the key provisions of all the contracts.
And the other thing I wanted to ask about is we've been interested in the racial and ethnic background, and in general, the union was led by white men for a long time. But I hear the name Rudy Mendoza. Was he of
He
Hispanic?
was Hispanic, and at that time there was another guy who was oh I'm sorry he was our international affairs director, and I'm blocking on his name too, but they were like the two Hispanics. There was I think there was some women who were assistants to executive vice presidents, but no one in an officer capacity.
Lou Moore.
Lou Moore, that's it. That's it. Very
Took me a
nice
minute.
man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good. So you, after working for Rudy Mendoza, you had a few years in the Public Worker Department and
I went
just.
from Rudy Mendoza to the research department. I worked, to be honest, I don't recall the years, but I got hired by Ronnie Straw because after the several years that I worked on pensions, I became an expert, relative to a lot of people. But knew how to talk to actuaries. That was key. So I got hired into the research department to do pension work, and also at that time got assigned to do health benefits work. And then after a few years there, went to the public workers department to be to work with Connie Bryant, the national director at the time. I think she was first a national director of public workers, and then later they made it into a vice president slot while she was still there.
And that was kind of the beginning of CWA trying to figure out how to have some kind of focus and structure institutionally
Right,
for our
right.
public and healthcare workers.
Exact. Well, yeah, that sort of came later too, but or at least in the sense of naming it, we had just organized New Jersey state workers. We already had a lot of public workers. We had county workers in New Jersey. We had city workers in New York. There was smatterings across the Midwest. Jeff, there were. I'm blocking in the District 4 states, but in Iowa there we had libraries, we had road cleaners, we had a lot of sort of these public sector unions because CWA tended to be everywhere, and when these workers were trying to organize, we were there, right? Often the only union in some of these towns, right? It was a smattering of public sector throughout the union, but with the New Jersey state workers, I can't remember how many tens of thousands we had at that time when we first organized them, but suddenly we were a presence, or they were a presence within the union, and we needed to figure out how to support them. And the national director was set up with the notion that it would be much like the natural director for the independents, as a clearinghouse for information, a way to convene workers so that they could share information about what's going on in their districts, identify problems that might cross all borders, and that sort of thing. It was, again, not a bargaining responsibility, but a support and networking opportunity, I guess.
And you mentioned Ohio, and maybe Jeff, you remember. I remember there was a period in which the organizing department went into Ohio after the state passed a
Right.
state
Yeah,
collective bargaining.
we passed a state collective bargaining law and brought in a bunch of people. Bob Muscat, I think, was heading up the operation. Carla Katz was one of the people that came in. A few others
Oh,
from New
really?
Jersey. Yeah, a
I
few
didn't
others
know
from New
that.
Jersey came in to help out. Helen Gibson was
Oh,
one of the
she
ones.
was the
Yeah,
the
yeah.
administrative support for organizing, yeah.
And they had this philosophy. There were these huge statewide units. And Bob had this philosophy, asked me, have kind of a leg up on the big statewide units. He thought if we would win a bunch of elections around the state, that that would give us momentum and state workers would then fall to our side. So we had like 19 election victories in a row, but they were for 12 people in this county, 9 people
Oh.
in this county, 48 people in this county. And when the big statewide elections came, we got trounced. So
And that was kind of the end of that.
the
Was that was the
momentum
end of the
theory didn't
Muscat?
work. Yes,
Yeah.
that was the end of Muscat as well. Yeah.
We
We
can edit.
tried to
Okay.
get Larry Cohen to come to town, but he was busy managing things in New Jersey at that point because they were still fresh with, everything going on there. So
But then he was brought in to replace Muscat, right? And yeah.
So this was the
To
early 80s.
Yeah,
Yeah.
early 80s.
Early
Because I had
mid.
just I came on staff in 81, and it was while I was on staff, so.
Okay.
So Louise, now I want to focus on what I think will be the biggest section of our conversation, or maybe even not so much a conversation.
You know,
Okay, I
can
forgot
I,
something. Yes.
no, I forgot something. There was something I did in the public sector that I would like to talk about. The Texas State Employees Union was
Oh,
also
yeah.
blossoming at that time. And I did a lot of work for them on healthcare and pensions. And then, the big thing that I'm still very proud of to this day was this big your pay equity was a key issue at that time. We were it was one of the issues that across the board we were trying to promote and figure out approaches to both identifying inequitable wages for women and then come up with solutions to be presented in a public sector arena. We actually, I think I left the book over here because I wanted to wave it at you. But we did this big survey of Texas jobs and had a report. The Texas, let me see if I have it. Oh, here it is. Job segregation and wage inequities in Texas state employment. This
Okay,
is de
we want
Debbie.
you to take a picture of that and send it to us after the interview.
So this is Debbie's heard me tell this story. I don't know how many times because I love it. Oh. But we went through every job title and split them out according to had this men and women and the wages. And I don't remember how many jobs we reviewed, but it was a lot. And what I had to work with at that time, this was 1984, was a calculator. And this was pre-computers, right? And we did these charts. We had all these charts in there that we did. This was the bottom of a Coke can. And these were, carefully drawn by hand.
Let me just say that Louise is showing a page that has a circle graph.
a pie chart. There were
A
bar
pie chart.
charts, pie charts. There, all kinds of charts. Anyway, it was this massive project. Deborah Greenfield, who was in our legal department at the time, and I did this work. And I some time ago ran into somebody from TSEU, and they told me people still talk about this there. I don't believe it. I think they were flattering me, but it was nonetheless it worked. I was flattered.
What impact did it have? How was it used?
They used it in a legislative campaign to boost wages for women, and were successful in sort of stair-stepping increases over time. So I think that's why it was used to good end in eliminating a lot of the differences in wages for women there.
So that was very early on in the Texas State Employees Union. And do you remember some of the leaders down there that you were working with?
Eliseo Medina was the head of TSU at the time, and I just remember a few of them. This was before Sandy Rusher. This was before Danny Fatante. There was a Jim Pearson. I don't remember who the head of. I think it was still, sort of an organizing campaign as opposed to being an officially recognized representative of the workers.
And can you talk a little bit about why CWA in Texas, a telephone union, got involved with organizing state workers?
To be honest, I don't, if I know, it's not that brain cell is not activated, but I do always think of it in terms of what is it? That famous John Kennedy speech where why do we go to the moon? It's because it's hard. We do it because it's hard, I think that's sort of it. It was something that needed to be done, and it was hard, and we're gonna grapple with it. That always, honestly, throughout my career at CWA, I've been in these situations where CWA is what they say, fighting above its weight. And we take on the battles that need to be fought, and I think that's what happened in
Okay.
TSEU. There's probably other more, less emotional, more practical reasons for it too that at the moment I don't recall.
Okay, now let's jump into it. 1983, you started working in the research, excuse me, 88, you came back to the research department. And George Cole is now the director. And you become the expert in healthcare bargaining and policy. I'm going to be very quiet for a while because I think you have quite a story to tell about that trajectory. Talk to us about it.
I think I do think that bargaining in 1989, it was really sort of where our whole view of healthcare and how to what we think about healthcare, how we value healthcare, how we work on healthcare change. Up to that time, it had been about paying less and less towards premiums, so that we would, and eventually we got fully paid healthcare at AT&T in the operating companies. And to be honest, I'm blanking on that year, but I think it was in the 70s. Is that, sorry, I don't recall when, but and then sort of staving off employers' subsequent attempts to shift those costs and to sort of take back that hard-won benefit by putting in cost containment initiatives. So it was always this sort of Chase, costs go up. We need to do second opinion surgeries. Costs keep going up. We need to have utilization review. There are all these gimmicks that we put in place to try to stave the rising cost of healthcare, so that and it was tough fights, right? In 83, there was a strike partially over healthcare. In 86, there was strikes that included healthcare as the cause, and it was all because of the rising costs and the company's attempts to make us pay part of the premium or higher out of pockets or whatnot. And it,
83 was a strike against the Bell system.
that's what I'm talking about, the Bell
And
system,
80,
yeah.
but 86 would have been a strike against AT&T because you now had the breakup of the Bell system. Is that correct that you're remembering?
Is when did the divestiture was when
84.
84, but that's when it was decreed. When it was it actually
Decreed in 82 took
in
place in
82?
84. So the 83 strike was before the breakup, but knowing the breakup was coming.
Right, that's what I was trying to remember too. So, and knowing the breakup was coming, that's why it was a shorter term than usual. Is that anyway?
Anyway,
Yeah,
there were strikes
there were
over
strikes over
health.
healthcare,
Okay, keep on with your narrative.
and at the same time, there was this realization that we can't, we're keep doing the same thing over and over again, and it doesn't get fixed. And the reason is because it's not our fault. It's not, we who are at this bargaining table don't control the cost of healthcare. Healthcare is driven by doctors and by hospitals and by insurance companies. Doctors push utilization. They tell patients what to do. We don't walk in and say, I would like this, this, and this. Doctors determine the utilization of healthcare. Hospitals determine costs by investing in technology and driving patients to use this high-tech equipment once they've got it. And so that drives costs. And then insurance companies, who are these, administrative overmasters that have all these rules that hospitals have to both develop administrative teams to comply with their rules, and then insurance companies have their own administrative overhead. So it's like all these, unless we get some control over those players, what we do at our bargaining table is going to, be at best short term, if at all effective. So in 1889, we came up with this two-pronged approach, one that was con we considered to be the short-term approach, which was sort of the next evolution of these cost containment strategies, and that was managed care networks. And so the managed care networks were considered, it was pretty, at that time, it was brand new. We had, there were very few employers who were offering them. There was only one telecom employer at the time that had dabbled with that, and that was Bell South. But we were proposing them because we felt that the kind of there's a trade-off. You restrict the access to care to a select providers who promise to follow utilization protocols and who agree to discounts. At the same time, you preserve the choice. So it was a point of service. You could choose to go to the traditional plan, or you could choose to use the discounted network. That was what we proposed as sort of, again, this short-term notion of controlling costs, but making the system more accountable to both the employer and to the union. The second path was acknowledging that it's, the rising health costs aren't our problem, and that we shouldn't have to negotiate over access to health care every year, that health care should be a right. And we asked the employers to join with us to look for a national solution to the health care problem, for national health care reform. And that it's pretty audacious, actually, for the time. But we did push that, and I'm proud of sort of help, well, drafting that approach. But Morty Barr was like there. He was there. He believed in the right to health care. He believed that it was eating up too much of our money at the bargaining table. He believed that no one should be without, and that if we have to strike, that anyone should be at risk is, what was appalling to him. And he really was such a fierce leader, both at the bargaining table and in other places on this. We had strikes. We had at they did not agree to that right off the bat, surprisingly, not surprisingly. And we had strikes. 200,000 workers, CBA members, on strike over health care at AT&T, 9X. American Tech was out, Jeff, but was I'm not recalling if that was if healthcare was an issue there at Ameritech. Pactel, though, and what have I mentioned? It was a 26-day strike for most of them. 9X stayed out for 17 weeks. So it was a powerful experience for us. It was sort of recognized throughout the labor movement and as being this great statement about healthcare. And it started being, we were written up in newspapers and magazines about the flashpoint that health benefits had become in union contracts.
Louise, you're talking about 1989, correct?
1989.
And we've had some conversation, particularly with Bob Master, also I think a little bit with Chris Shelton and Dennis Traynor, about the 89 strike over health benefits for all, not health cuts at 9X. I'm
Yeah,
less
that I just
familiar.
want to say that was their thing, and they had it was a different fight at 9X than it was for the other units. And since they talked to you about it, I won't talk about 9X, but the slogan in the other units was cutting our health benefits is a sick idea, and the notion is the just what I said before. We're not causing the health cost problem. The system is, let's go to the system. And we had at the convention that year, this was another, taking you back in time. This is pre-PowerPoint, when we used those, we call them slides, but it was transparencies, and things were written on transparencies. Morty had each district at the convention do it sort of a stand down, if you will, and had them each make this presentation about the healthcare crisis and what we can do at our bar, what it means for our bargaining. And it was like a 30, it was a long presentation, like 30 slides. I can't remember how many, it was very long. But I think it was the bargaining chairs that tended to give these presentations, and with the notion being that we're making a change in how we talk about healthcare. We've got a new understanding about how healthcare impacts us, and is a way to educate our leaders, the local leaders, and then hopefully get our members more prepared for the change to come.
And the change being moving to managed care.
Moving to managed care and thinking about national health care reform.
So this was the convention in 89. Do you remember, was that before the strikes or after the strikes?
Well, that's a good point. It was my recollection is it was before, but I'd have to look at some other notation to confirm that. Could it have been 88?
I think
I
it
can't.
was before. I'm sorry. I think it was after the strikes from the other units, but before the 9X strike ended. Because I seem to recall 9X still being on strike when we were at convention, and the rest of us had all settled by then.
And so, what was in the other units? Did we negotiate in 89 the beginnings of managed care?
Not in all of them, but definitely in AT&T, and I believe Bell Atlantic and US West got seated, if you will, there. The difference was at AT&T. This story, I remember this story of Morty was, I'm pointing upstairs. He was upstairs. And I was, waiting for things to happen. He had the AT&T CEO, whose name I forget at the time, and was really buttonholing him about healthcare and wouldn't let him out of the room. An agreement was reached, and he got, into the nitty-gritty of what a managed care network would look like. So they like, anyway, they set these parameters for managed care that was not something that had been seen in the industry at the time. But it included that our joint healthcare committees would oversee them and help design and implement the programs. That was unique to AT&T. The other companies that implemented managed care sort of took it off the shelf package from the insurance companies. I'm not going to say which one was best. It was pretty hard working at AT&T on it. But the other thing, so once they got an agreement on that, he still wouldn't let them out. He said, this isn't going to be the end of it. You've got to work with us. I wonder if one of his books has his story about that night, but that's how it was presented to me by someone from the company, not by Morty.
So I want to slow down a little bit because I think this is quite important. What I heard from you is the concept of managed care. Somebody was educating you and maybe George about it, George Cole. And these big companies that also have an interest in containing healthcare costs and have huge benefits departments and experts. But this idea is coming from the union to the companies. Were their benefits departments, did they know about this? Or you were educating them?
Bell, as I said, Bell South had already implemented such a program that at the time managed care was being written about in those kind of healthcare journals and stuff. And we George and I actually started meeting with this woman, Kathy Shane, and I think she was with SEIU at the time.
Yes.
And she knew a bit about it, so we got briefed there. But our understanding was, this deep. for a topic that's this deep, right? And it really was more a framework to think about what we wanted out of healthcare. And it was, key things being that it was benefits had to be comprehensive, it had to be affordable, it had to be that we had to assure the quality of the care. And did I already say accountability? So we wanted it to be accountable. Those are the things we started sort of listing as our framework for what we wanted out of healthcare. Those were principles that we developed both there and then subsequently. But at any rate, yes, we really were in the AT&T region or contract, we were developing the networks according to some parameters that had been laid out in the contract by Morty. And like for example, he had some really great stuff that he put in there. And one that I remember is that we're not going to change to this new system and sort of tear people away from their traditional plan. So we had a transition of care to assure continuity of care. There was a transition period, which was something he thought about. That was not on my list of things that, so he came up with that. That was pretty brilliant. But any rate,
So during your note to me says you served on the Joint Labor Management Healthcare Cost Containment Committees at AT&T, Lucent, US West, and Bell Atlantic. Also worked with Southwestern Bell Committee as it gobbled up Ameritech, Pactel, and Bell South. So this was something you were doing in the 90s. And what impact did it have? Maybe you want to describe what you did and then what impact it had and how
yeah.
long it was effective.
The AT&T Joint Committee, it actually became kind of a pilot, if you will, because things that we learned and developed there, we could pass on to the other units and for them to consider and adopt in their negotiations. But the AT&T committee was two people from CWA, two people from IBEW, and then technically voting on the committee, two people from AT&T, a benefits department and a labor department. But they also had early on, they had this medical director on the committee. They had and we had tons of resources, including, I have to say, an excellent at the AT&T table, this excellent consultant from what came to be, I think it was Towers Perrin, but I think their name has changed now after some gobbling up, but just a super consultant who made this into a real learning experience as well as a practical development piece. We put together an RFP. We sent it out to insurance companies. We interviewed them. We selected them. We went around them with them or meeting with them in local places to talk about their networks in different sites. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm remembering an incident that happened in Cleveland. We had these site visits, and we'd go and talk to we had local committees, and so local committees would meet with us and talk about what they think of the plan we had for the network in their site, and then give us feedback and make requests. So For example, in Atlanta, there was a particular hospital that our members felt needed to be in the network. So things like that. But in Cleveland, Jeff, forgive me, what was John, what was the local number? John Ryan was on the committee and
4309.
John and I'm terrible with remembering names. My apologies, but
Eddie Phillips.
not Ed Phillips, fellow who died.
Seth.
No. It's the story. We'll protect the innocent. Oh.
Bernie Bernie Hill.
No. Forgive me for not remembering, but
Oh, that's
here's the story. We go there, and they have this fabulous presentation about the network that we're submitting to them for review. And they had charts and posters and maps and had done this thorough, analysis of healthcare access, because that was our networks. It was we had choice of docs within X miles and choice of hospitals within, so many hospitals within another set of miles. And they were showing us that we were all wrong. And particularly we were wrong because we didn't take into account all the traffic in Cleveland. And so, time and mileage matter. And I was blown away by their presentation. And we had a guy on the company side on this committee who was actually not on the committee, but he was one of the resources that we had from the benefits department. And he was obstinate. He just, wouldn't take any input. This is ridiculous. They're done. I took him out in the hallway, and this is not my style generally, but I took him out in the hallway, and honestly, I pushed him against the wall, and I'm pounding on him. I was like, "I can't believe you're doing this. This is exactly what we need. We need people engaged in the system, and they've done all this work, and they know this city better than anybody." And blah blah blah. I went on, and so we go back into the meeting, and okay, he agrees to the changes. And then these guys are driving me to back to the airport, and we're coming out of a parking garage, and the driver, I can't remember his name, he looks down the street and he goes, "Oh my gosh." And he looks down the street and he goes, "Oh my gosh, look at all the traffic." And honestly, there were like four cars on the road. And they just started laughing. Anyway, I never heard anything more about it. And the network was established, but that's a funny story. But I'll tell you what, the local folks got deeply involved in making, and there was always, two or three people in a city who knew the health benefits plan, knew the health care system within that local, because they usually had a personal or a family situation that made them need to understand the health care system. And so they that was another thing that came out of these our work on the joint committee was it came to pass that we realized the value of having local experts, not only to know the local healthcare system, but to help folks in that area navigate the new systems we were developing. And so we came up with a new title and pushed this in bargaining, and it was accepted. I don't remember what the year was, but obviously subsequently. I think the title was Benefits Coordinator. And I actually came to believe during the course of my work that that was the most important thing that ever happened on the healthcare front, was having that sort of local expertise to help our members navigate the system. They became, I think, real heroes to folks who needed their help.
We'll come back to the public policy side, which I want to have plenty of time for. But just to continue this, for how long would you say that the managed care networks were able to lower the
Yeah,
curve of cost? And what
they
did that?
did. And in fact, there was one year there was where there was no increase. And I think we got through two rounds of bargaining because of the effectiveness of the managed care networks. In other words, healthcare wasn't a flashpoint in negotiations for the in that way. For, I guess, what would that have been, 92 and
95, we were still on a triennial for the Bell system. So it again began to pop out in 98.
It, to
And
be honest, I don't recall, but I do remember this, that there were two rounds of bargaining that we got through without headache, and we could make what we did in those years was try to make improvements to the networks, including, these coordinators that I just talked about, and expanding some benefits.
how were we able, or you able, to avert the major criticism today of managed care, which is that it's all about gatekeepers and saving money by reducing the amount of care?
Well, I mean, I do think that it's a problem. I think, I don't know that it's a controllable problem anymore, to be honest with you, unless we actually do get the kind of national health care reform that it institutes price controls and, imposes budgets on hospitals and all the kind of devices that is in, a part of a national health insurance scheme. On the other hand, those countries that do have those kind of systems in place also have issues with rationing, with delay of treatment, with rising health cost, and that sort of thing. So it's the kind, it's healthcare. It's something you don't, you're not gonna mess around with. It's life and death. So it's just it's a system here still that's not accountable in any way to, a budget. Anyway, we'll go. Are we going into policy now?
I think so, unless you want to add anything more about the bargaining.
I can't think. Let me. I had some scribbles here. The one thing I would say about those networks, what beyond preserving our health benefits, they became, in some companies, not in all, but at definitely Bell Atlantic, and then and US West and AT&T, there was this sense that the union built the plan, and so it was worth fighting for and protecting. And so to be able to create that kind of a dynamic around a benefit that previously had been, just the employer's business. We just get our ID card and go to the doctor. Did a couple of things. It not only did it give us a real energy around the benefits plan, but it developed leaders, people who became experts in healthcare, became essential at the bargaining tables, became, staff members. You could see the progression, so That was a very cool experience too. I'm thinking Ron Hans in District 4 was one of those who really sort of knuckled down and learned the system. And then I think my sense is he became he was at the on a bargaining committee, but then he got on staff. So he was just the model for others who took that pathway to leadership.
Christy
Oh.
Darling was another one in District
Oh
4.
gosh, Christy Darling,
Yeah.
she was a darling. She was,
Yeah.
yeah, before Ron. Yeah, she was
Yeah.
the one. Absolutely.
Okay, let's talk about CWA getting engaged in policy.
Right.
And I don't know if you want to go before 92, but certainly 92, 93, Clinton comes in and there's going to be, well, before Clinton comes in, there's an effort to elevate healthcare reform onto the policy agenda. So talk about, I think back then, and then move into the Clinton health plan and what CWA
Yeah,
did.
yeah. So again, it goes back to this the 89 bargaining and the language we got about national healthcare reform, and we went in a couple, several different directions after that. And one was keeping the companies to their word. Morty, with the and. I'm trying to remember the guy. I think it was the general telephone guy who headed up this telecom industry healthcare consortium. There was a title of it. And they would meet, and Morty would try to coax them into stepping up and stepping out on the need for healthcare reform. And honestly, I think they came out of respect for CWA and they came out of respect for Morty. But they would sit in these meetings and we'd have experts come in and talk to them, and we'd have presentations that we would make. But they were just, not into it. And so I think Morty tired of that. And he recruited them into this National Leadership Coalition on Healthcare, which was this big coalition of many employers and healthcare providers and unions that would sit together and hash out what a national healthcare reform plan for the US today might look like. And so that the company, the our company members came, and it was AT&T was there, and Verizon Bell Atlantic was there, US West was there. They came, but they were, the people they put on this committee were their lobbyists who tend to be, out of their DC offices here. Who tended to be, conservative Republicans, and not, and I think again, it felt like they were coming because they were told to come, not because they were told to, make something happen. And on the other hand, we at the same time were getting involved in talks at the AFL-CIO. There's a healthcare task force at the AFL-CIO that I sat on for, and we were hammering out what would be a labor approach to national healthcare reform, and it broke down into two, I think it was just two camps, but there might have been more, but there was. And that was extensive work led by Karen Ignani, who was at the, I can't remember what her title was there at the AFL, but she had a heck of a job trying to lasso all these disparate unions into trying to get to one unified position. And we went on trips to Canada and explored that. We had people from, I mean, it was pretty massive undertaking to educate ourselves about healthcare and what we might look for. Eventually, though, it dissolved. There were two camps. One was the pay or play approach, which meant you either provide your own, an employer would have to provide its own plan, or else its workers would have to be covered by, a national health care plan.
And the
And that
company would have to pay into a fund.
would have to make a contribution to the fund with to finance the coverage for its employees. And then there was the single payer camp, which is where we landed. That is, we wanted a single national health insurance plan along the lines of the Canadian system, but customized, for America. And so that was, those were interesting times too. And the unions in that camp tended to be the industrial unions. There was the UAW, their machinist, the IUE, AFSCME was there, steel. I've forgotten them all, but they're what this is another, CWA playing above its weight. Morty was really the sort of the linchpin there. He would call the meetings of these union presidents prior to AFL-CIO executive board meetings, and so they would meet, and all of us, there would be an agenda, and we would be wanting them to stay tight, stay together. So that when they went to the executive board, they would, assert the right things to propose or to push for a single payer national health insurance plan.
And can you explain, as you've talked about the two camps, what were the basis for the industrial unions and CWA and AFSCME primarily being for single payer? And as I recall, the payer play was the building trades. SEIU was a strong
Yeah,
advocate.
it tended to be those unions that got their benefits through their own health insurance programs that they subsidized or that they provided were pay or play. And the unions like CWA, whose benefits came through the collective bargaining process and were paid for by the employer, tended to be the single payer camp. The building trades really saw a lot of their identity with those plans. They some of the plans that they had were quite extensive and impressive. But their connection, because of the nature of that those unions, I think that became a real sort of brand for them. Their benefits plan was like their brand. And the notion of a national health insurance plan, even though those plans were being affected by the same cost problems that the employer-sponsored plans were, they didn't know what they would do with themselves if they didn't have these benefits to provide. And so it was, they saw it as survival. And whereas, we did too, but in a different way, right? We saw our collective bargaining being just blown up year after year because of healthcare cost increases and our benefits shrinking as a result. But they, so at any rate, the two camps had two different interests, and they're never was a final single AFL-CIO endorsed plan. The single payer unions sort of moved off, and these unions also tended to be the jobs with justice unions. And so we did our healthcare work predominantly through jobs with justice. And at that time, one of our big partners in jobs with justice was Citizen Action, where our friend and colleague Kathy Hurwit was the real sort of maven of of healthcare reform, and that's how we got our work done. And the campaign for health security evolved under Jobs with Justice. It sort of devolved into Kathy being our policy expert and the link to other community organizations, other advocacy organizations. And I was the one who sort of lassoed the single payer unions together. And between the two of us, we kept this raucous group together to push for first the Wellstone plan, Paul Wellstone single payer healthcare plan, and then also I should say not first the Jim McDermott. Jim McDermott had a single payer plan in the House. Those were the plans that we endorsed and advocated for.
And talk about your caravan across America.
I was trying to remember when that was. I can't remember what year that happened, but it was the notion was to raise awareness of that these plans are out there, that healthcare change is on the way. We had Citizen Action, I think, got the ambulances. I can't remember how many there were, but there were probably more than half a dozen, but I don't know if there were a dozen, but a bunch of us starting at different points in the country in these ambulances that, decommissioned, but are now plastered on the side with a campaign for health security. And we would drive from city to city and have these, town hall style, talks and rallies, and collect postcards that we had devised, saying things like cutting health benefits is a sick idea, and collecting them and driving them back to be delivered to the White House. My route was Portland. I think it was Portland to Boise to what's the capital of Wyoming? Cheyenne. And I think I ended in Denver, and someone else took over. But it was, any rate, it was an interesting diversion. It was also Fred Ascarrati at the time was at Citizen Action and was the sort of coordinator, mastermind of the drive, and he said he'd never do it again. It was a mayhem.
Before we move in time, which we know the outcome, which was the Clinton administration endorsed a plan that was more like payer play than it was like single payer, and it didn't make it through Congress. Do you want to talk about any more mobilization activities that you were, or education activities that you did for the CWA members at that time?
For the Clinton plan, I know
Or
we did.
for you, or single payer at that point.
Debbie, I have to say everything starts to blur together, but we did a lot of educating. We did a lot of again, through Jobs with Justice, a lot of work on it. The Clinton plan was a disappointment. As you say, it was a pay or play approach, and we put so much into it, working for a single payer, and then got what we what we had told the Clinton plan. The Clinton folks were was not going to be good enough in it, and it exploded. I think it failed for a bunch of reasons. We were lukewarm about it, only supported it really because it was Clinton and it was our greatest hope at the time for getting anything done. But it really didn't meet our criteria for what we wanted in healthcare reform. And then there was the Harry and Louise ads. Do you remember those that really sort of torpedoed it? And it was true. I mean, the bill came in a book about this thick. The Health Security Act.
Your hands showed about 6 inches thick.
Yeah, maybe it was only four, but it was big. It shows this man and woman at the kitchen table, trying to figure out what their health care is going to be like. And it was devastating. I think it was very effective in making people scared they would lose their health care. So that, yeah,
So
that
if we
failed.
continue with the policy, then although I do want to ask one other thing, because I think with Jeff here, as I recall, there was always an attempt to get our employers to understand that they were subsidizing the companies that were not contributing to employee benefit, healthcare benefits. And as I recall, and we had this in one of our interviews, Jeff, at one point you had the CEO of Ameritech, Notabart, who
Oh,
was about ready to sign on with you and do a joint press conference. Was that during the Clinton years?
yeah, that was during the Clinton years. Morty had was trying to get any one of the regional Bell operating companies to sign on.
Right.
And we finally got Notabart to agree to sign on to the employer mandate portion of the plan.
Right.
And so he did. And Morty flew to Wisconsin and Notabart flew to DC so he could fly back to Wisconsin with Morty. And we had a big event up there. And then Notabart was savaged by the rest of the business community in the Midwest, who threatened to take business away from Ameritech, and that he needed to get off that bandwagon. So he had signed on, but he was effectively muted
Yeah.
after it came up publicly for it. But just to me, it's part of who Morty was. I mean, he's just always looking for that other angle to try and
Yeah.
leverage, and
Yeah.
having each of us try to get to our connections with the employers to get them to sign on board.
And this was not the first time, I'm sure, Louise, that you experienced where class solidarity by the employers
Oh
trumped
my
their own
gosh.
self-interest.
Yeah. Absolutely. That work on the National Leadership Coalition, it wasn't leading to a place that we were comfortable with it, because we were so now at this point embedded in the single payer approach. But it was showing all kinds of different ways that employers could preserve their healthcare and save money if there were a national health plan. So they just wouldn't budge. I think, and Jeff, you probably know this better than I, but I think part of the reason, and it could be that somebody actually said this to me from the company, they don't like to get involved in anything that smacks of regulation. They don't want to think that they don't want anyone to think that they agree that there should be more government regulation. And so, because they wanted their industry to, they want government hands off our industry. So they didn't feel comfortable saying that, on the other hand, the healthcare industry needs to be wrapped in all kinds of regulations. So yeah, there was definitely the cabal of the corporations, right, standing in the way of major reform.
Notabart showed me a couple of the messages he got from some of his
Oh,
corporate
really?
counterparts, and they were pretty nasty. I mean, he took a beating
Wow.
for stepping out like that. And
Did he ever step out again? Or did he
no.
step down?
Yeah. Well, then they were taken up by SBC,
Oh, right.
Ed Whitaker became the CEO, and Notabart went out to US West and became the CEO out there for a few minutes.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, I don't remember that.
Yeah.
Let's jump now. I'm sorry to intervene there. Let's jump now to the prelude to and the Obama healthcare period.
Okay. I do want to say one more thing because this became important to me and how I sort of conducted my work or framed my work, whatever you want to say. And the w during the campaign for health security, we the coalition spent a lot of time hammering out the principles we wanted to see in healthcare reform and, and they were, well, I mentioned them before, but I did want to mention them again because it turns out they apply to so many things. But we came up with five, and they were, and I wrote them down because I always forget one: universal, comprehensive, affordable, quality, and accountability. And that those principles is how we, judge any kind of legislation that came through. And then for me, it became a way to sort of frame bargaining demands, towards towards the end of my career, the affordability principle became a key in health benefit negotiations at all the companies. AT&T, in particular, is that they were pushing, for greater cost sharing. And I don't know where they are now, Jeff. I don't know if you've kept in touch with it, but I think we now have a, well, that's sort of another conversation. But it was it always became helpful to me. And we think about it in so many different ways, Debbie. I mean, from the even in broadband. To think about what do we want from a broadband program, and we want it to be universal, comprehensive, affordable. It's sort of these are the principles that guide the way we see the world or want the world to be, right?
Yes. Let me stop. We're getting on to almost 3 o'clock. And Jeff, you have a hard stop, correct? Am I correct?
No, I'm good.
Oh, okay.
I'm good.
Okay. And Hannah, you're good?
I have to get it off by like 3:20.
Okay. So
Okay.
let's
I
try
won't
and.
do any more asides.
Oh, the asides are always the best part.
Exactly.
Let me squeeze in. At some point, you became the research director. You'd been the assistant director, and you became the research director. Your timeline says 2000 named assistant director of research. That's when George Cull became an
Went
assistant
upstairs,
to
right?
Morty Barr. And you were, although they didn't give you the title, you were running the research department, and eventually you got the title. That's a story in itself. But let's jump ahead then to the prep for knowing, hoping that Obama would be elected president after how many years of Republicans, and that the issue of healthcare reform might be on the agenda again. What did you do? What did CWA do to push first before the election, then during the campaign. Talk about that.
Before the election and during the campaign.
I could be wrong. I know that this was connected with developing the Legislative Political Action Committee training. So I don't know if you want to start with that.
I was trying, I know you've talked to Annie about that, and I'm trying to remember when we started the work on the LPATs. So that had to have been the first strategic industry fund, if not, among the first. So whenever those were enacted,
I think
that would have
around
been.
2008.
That's what I'm thinking too. Okay, good.
And Obama is elected in the fall of 08, and he takes office in 09, and he says that health care is going to be one of his priorities.
Right. And so we developed a proposal to fund essentially a healthcare campaign out of the Strategic Industry Fund. Is that what they were called initially? I think so. Yeah. And what we developed was the legislative political action teams, which were individuals selected by districts to be trained in about actually a bunch of things, but content-wise on healthcare, but also some basic things about how to talk to people about controversial issues, about how to develop their own stories that help illuminate an issue, how to draw out stories from others to illuminate the issue. And it was pretty extensive training, pretty, boot camp kind of stuff. And we had trainings. I think we had two districts per training. So we'd have these intensive trainings with two districts and these appointed LPATers who then would be sent back to their districts to train locals. And we had schedules for trainings. We had, and then that they would do. And then their work would include scheduling a series of meetings with the members of Congress, and then particularly with targeted members of Congress as the health reform debate moved on, so that we could focus on the key sites. Again, I know you talked with Annie. She's probably talked a lot about it. What my key thought about those LPATs too. Hey, I think they're still in existence. But they became just like what I said about the joint committees and the people who took ownership. These folks who came through the LPAT training became our next generation of leaders. They, many of them in that first round of training are, well, I'm saying are now. They became staff when I was still there. Some of them may be retired now. But at any rate, not only did they become these sort of mobilizers for our membership to push healthcare reform, but they became leaders within the union as they utilized this training to become movers of people on any issue. Also should say that although initially the notion was that the LPATs would be focused on healthcare, the other thing that was moving, or we hoped would be moving at the same time, was the Employee Free Choice Act. And so the training also incorporated the Employee Free Choice Act and obviously then we were also using these teams to move that legislation, which never got out of, it didn't go anywhere. It was in spite of Democratic majority in the Senate, it never got to the floor, and that was a huge disappointment.
Kennedy got sick, and I think somebody else got sick, and that was, we couldn't overcome the filibuster. But back to the
Oh, that's right. I'd forgotten that, Debbie.
LPATs. What I'm hearing from you is that it was a combination of creating a grassroots political structure,
Right.
and health care was an issue that all our members cared about, and it was on the agenda. So using that issue as a way to give action to these grassroots and regional structures. And how is that different from the political structure? Did CWA not have a political grassroots political structure before this?
Well, that's a good question. And Jeff, maybe you answer it better than I do, but I think maybe the missing component is a national accountability. At least during that time, on those two issues, this was we were relying on the grassroots, the our locals to de deliver this, but the plan came out of national, and that we are the systems that we put in place had them reporting to the structure at national. I shouldn't say it's not, it wasn't all command and control kind of thing, because there were different levels. There was a we had local coordinators, we had district coordinators, so they were all structured much like the union. But those two programs, in terms of what we wanted out of the structure we developed, came out of the national.
And I think up until then, the lobbying piece of the work was focused in D.C. and just out of the headquarters office. And this was the first attempt to really engage back home. I mean, we had our COPE program, and we had relationships with many of these members back home, but. But the actual asks were always done in their offices in DC, and once a year we'd go to the legislative conference, and that would be it. This was to take that next step and get people engaged
Right.
at a much deeper level.
Right. True dat.
And did it work?
Jeff, you tell us.
Well, I don't know. We got some form of health care. We didn't get employee free choice. And you tell me, did it work?
Well, I guess the did it work for me is that it regardless of the health care or the Employee Free Choice Act, we've got this new structure
Yeah,
that's
that's right.
engaging our members,
Exactly.
and that's pretty powerful. We didn't get the Employee Free Choice Act. The Obama plan was, I'd have to go back and go through my list of criteria for reform and see how it fared. But I don't think it might be a C, but it might be a D, because what we were looking for was getting health care off the bargaining table and getting some real relief for our collective bargaining. And it did not deliver on that. It did expand access to health care. It expanded Medicaid. It put in these new marketplaces for the uninsured to get health care at affordable rates, which, that was wonderful. That was remarkable. That was the greatest thing we've ever done since the Medicare and Medicaid Act. But it didn't help us at the bargaining table, right? So it was, and in addition, one of the features they put in the plan was an excise tax on what they called high cost health plans, which meant on that, which were our plans, and we had to rally against that. We had to mobilize against the excise tax and show that it would, hurt our plans. We were able to get, as a result, some exceptions for plans with older folks in them, and our plans tend to be, our members tend to be on the older side. And for retiree, or I'm sorry, oh, high risk jobs. So some of our jobs are fall into the category of high risk jobs. And another thing we got, which little known fact, the one company who was working with us at that time was Verizon, believe it or not. The woman who was the head of the DC office, Debbie, I know you know her, and I'm blocking on her name.
Kathy, Kathy.
Kathy something or other. Yeah. It was a Democrat in that office, and she was constantly looking for ways to work with us. And we were trying to recruit Verizon into being, the Ameritech of the time. No such luck, of course. But she did. Oh, we lost.
We lost Jeff. Keep talking. He'll come back on.
She did agree to work on this a retiree healthcare group, and so it was CWA, IBEW, and Verizon, and we developed an approach about creating subsidies for retiree healthcare for employers who were providing retiree healthcare, because my great fear it was that employers were already trying to unload the obligation they had for retiree healthcare, and they dump them onto these new marketplaces. So there was a provision put in the bill to offer employers who were providing retiree healthcare subsidies for a few years. I've forgotten how long it was. It didn't last forever, but it was intended to provide some relief for this initial period of time. And that got put into the Obama healthcare plan. We worked with Verizon on that.
As I recall, welcome back, Jeff. As
Thanks.
I recall,
I wasn't plugged in and my battery died.
oh no.
Yeah, so I'm plugged back in now. So,
Okay.
as I recall, the excise tax or the Cadillac for
The Cadillac tax,
Cadillac
right?
plant wasn't going to kick in for 10 years or something. There was a big delay.
It was a delay, right?
Was
That,
my
yeah, you're right. That was another thing that we were able to do, is delay it. But any rate, it still got put in. We had that became an issue in bargaining too. So
Well,
not only
Louise,
are costs rising, but they're going to slap on this additional tax.
we could talk about many, many other things, but I think you've given quite a broad overview of, let's see, from 89, 90. You retired in what year?
18.
Okay, so 89, 99, 2009, eight, almost 30 years of working on healthcare. Do you want to give any summation or broad comments about unions and negotiating about health care and whether this system is one? Any thoughts about it?
Well, I'll just, yeah. Again, back to the principles that we developed. It does seem to me that those are the things that we believe in, and as a union, that everyone should have health care, that they should have all the health care they need. So universal, comprehensive, that it has to be affordable, and And we want quality health care. And at the time, we defined quality health care as including a unionized healthcare workforce as the sort that's how you assure patient quality of care. And then, oh, the accountability part. And so, in our bargaining, the accountability part became the joint healthcare committees and the benefit coordinators, right? Anyway, those pieces became sort of like, as I said, sort of guideposts for where we're moving to. We have learned, as these stories tell, that progress can be painfully slow. Oh. And so the Obama plan has advanced our national, healthcare to the extent that we've got more people. At the time in 1989, there were 30 million uninsured, and it grew and it grew and it grew until the Obama plan. And now more and more that uninsured number every year since Obama has been declining. We should take credit for that, even though it didn't meet all of our criteria. But that's the painfully slow part. And accepting that can be tough. But if you have the principles that guide you, you can mark your progress by those principles and keep going and keep being creative to find and figure out the next step.
Hannah, your turn.
Sure. So in your notes, Louise, you said in your early years, you had a memorable experience of your first time at the bargaining table in
Oh, God.
1983 in Trover Clinic. And then also it was heartbreaking when the unit was later decertified. So I was wondering
Yeah.
if you could tell those two stories.
Yeah. The Trover Clinic. Does it say what year that was? Now I've forgotten.
1983.
Oh yeah, so that was very early in my career. I was had just moved into the research department from the Labor Management Pension Fund. Had th this group of healthcare workers, predominantly female healthcare workers, organized at this clinic in somewhere in Kentucky. And under the noses of these doctors who owned the clinic, and the doctors were taken by surprise when they delivered their union cards, and it had to be and there was an election. They were wrecked. They won. It was just this amazing story in this very anti-union climate, and these sort of arrogant doctors who owned this clinic who thought they knew best, better than these young women who organized themselves. They had a pension plan, and I don't remember all the details of the plan, but they were trying to cut them out of the pension plan, or at least cut the benefits in the pension plan that at the bargaining table when we went for the first contract. And Ed Schultz was the national director of public workers at the time. So this is pre-Connie Bryant. And he had never negotiated. He came out of the county workers in New Jersey, and he had never negotiated a private sector contract. So he was having a rough time. In addition, the doctors had hired this rabid, union busting law firm, and they were sort of eating him up. Ed was having a hard time. The young women who were on the bargaining committee were feeling very, battered from the beating they're taking from these anti-union lawyers. And And anyway, there's this pension issue, and there's this simple question that they put to the union too, that we had to assert that the plan was qualified under rules, that it was an IRS qualified plan. And you know, this I used that as a leverage point to start asking questions about to make it certified. It had to be you had to show that it did not favor higher paid employees. And so I started asking questions about this, and Ed brought me to, he didn't want to talk about it. Ed brought me to the bargaining table, first time I'd ever been to the bargaining table. And I'm a young, sweet thing, and I'm showing you how I set it. Well, you can't see, but I was so nervous. When I held my paper, it shook. So I put my paper down on the table and sat on my hands and started asking them these questions about what, you know, that related to, is this a qualified plan? And they, you know, just one of the questions I asked was, could you tell me how much, you know, all the doctors are paid? Because I needed to find out if the plan favored highly qualified, these highly qualified individuals. And the bargaining chair for the other side, this very prim, you know, he's just straight laced, very his jacket just so he was very pressed, you know, he looked very neat and tidy. Ed, it I don't know, Debbie, if you knew Ed, but Jeff, I think you knew him. He was this guy. Ed was the kind whose papers were all over the table, and his
His
tie
lunch was
was.
on his tie.
Which was on his tie. He, and you know, he was just a, they were just total, you know, opposites. And at any rate, Ed's like always messing around with his papers, and I'm asking these questions, and the negotiator for the management got so pissed off. Honestly, you could see his face turning red. And he finally just slaps, he says, this session is over. And he slaps his stuff together and they all storm out of the room. And I'm sitting there with my hands still under my legs. And like, what just happened? And there's like total silence for a moment. And then these young women who had been just feeling so oppressed just lapped up and they started. So the next time I went back and I said that they wouldn't give us the information. So what I did was, and this was George Cole helped me with this idea, or that they wouldn't give us the information. So let's make some assumptions about what these doctors might make. And I did these calculations based on what their pensions would be under different scenarios of wages. I presented this. And again, the guy just furious, you know, because under each scenario, it showed that the plan favored highly compensated employees and so would not be qualified under IRS rules. And at any rate, he storms out again. The next time we meet, the third time, they're ready to settle. We got a double-digit wage settlement. The plan is preserved. You know, it's just Ed couldn't have been happier. The women couldn't have been happier. It couldn't have been you know, a better experience for me as first time at a bargaining table. And so it was glorious. The contract then, you know, sad part of the story. Next time around, the company started a desert campaign, and this is a great pardon me, this is funny. It was a great disappointment. There was like nobody paying attention. And the at that time, this unit in Kentucky in District 3, it was oddball. It was an oddball unit. They didn't know how to deal with them. Our staff, that is, didn't know how to deal with this, a bunch of nurses. And when the problems came up, there was like no one in charge. There was no one who could take it on. And the young women who fought so hard for this, couldn't keep the unit together, and it was deserted. So it was pretty heartbreaking. I know that Larry Cohen has used this story at times to talk about, our responsibilities and our need to, service every unit and find ways to do it. If we don't know how to find a way to do it, so that, yeah, that was a great disappointment.
Hannah, you're going to have to leave us soon. Can I continue for a few minutes? You want to ask anything else? I'm glad you asked that because I think it was a graphic story and it told a lot about who you are, Louise. Tenacious, focused on the members. I'm getting to the end also of my questions. I wanted to ask you, you were the first woman research director for CWA.
No, I wasn't. No, there
Oh.
was a woman. There was a woman back in the day. I couldn't remember her name, but prior to Ronnie's, the woman before Ronnie Straw who hired me. I mean, it was with the woman or the director before Ronnie Straw was a
Oh,
woman.
okay. That was going to lead me to ask changing role of women within the union. That's a question.
And the question is, what is the changing role?
Did you see a lot
I couldn't be more pleased that the two people who followed me as director are women. I think that's pretty very cool. And it does seem like we're more and more, you look at the staff roster now about who's in what, and a lot of women in the jobs that had previously, been male, both in elected positions and on staff. So that is wonderful to see.
One other thing that I wanted to ask you about when you were talking about the LPATs, it came to my mind that what you were describing, the change in the legislative program, was applying the concepts of mobilization to a legislative program. I
That's
just
right.
want you to put that in words in case we need to use a soundbite.
Well, I mean, the concept of mobilization in the sense that we had it was that structure. I mean, the mobilization structure. We had our team going out into the locals and forming local teams and activists there.
And it was.
That would then, mobilize around these particular issues. I assume, I mean, that they're using them now for just about everything, right?
But the concept that our power was not a lobbyist in Washington, our power
Right,
was
right.
the power of activating our membership and educating the membership.
Right. Yeah, those the keys to mobilization was, educate and then mobilize them, and that was definitely what that was all about. I think Annie Hill, who was put in charge of that SIF and developing that program, that was how she operated in her district when she was vice president, and really saw the value in that model, both from the bargaining table and otherwise. So it became a key part of the structure.
What did your 40 years of working in the labor movement in CWA, what did that mean for you? What did it mean for your life?
I have to say, when I started at CWA, I had no notion that I would be there that long. It gave me the meaning, that you want out of a life, right? It gave a sense of cause, and as I told you early on, this sort of the sense of mission that I got back in Cape Canaveral under my dad's watchful eye. There's just nothing like it. Someone had this phrase that I have never forgotten. And it really speaks to my experience with CWA. Everybody has two ambitions, this person said. And one is to be somebody, and the other is to be part of something. And CWA allowed both for me. So I got to blossom as in this in all these arenas that I never imagined growing up. But I got to blossom with this wonderful organization that just led me down a path that was meaningful to me. Period.
That's our sound bites.
Jeff, any more? That's anything you want to add or ask?
No, I that last little segment there, that's our little sound bite for I mean, I think that encapsulates. I haven't ever been able to put it into words, but you want to be something, you want to do something, and you want to be part of something, and being part of a union has enabled us to be both of those things, accomplish both of those. And that's really remarkable when you think about it, because not everybody gets that opportunity to be a part of an organization that is a collective rather than a top-down sort of hierarchy. Yeah, it's great.
I no, I feel very lucky, very fortunate.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
And the union was very fortunate to have you.
Oh
Do
my.
you want to add anything? I know there's so much else we could have
I
touched on.
I have to say, just not for the history, but just the experience of having to think about my career, to be honest with you, that I've just kind of, although I sort of sit in the glow of it every now and then, think about how lucky I am. I hadn't really thought about specific things. So the questions that you posed to me in that in your email about what to expect made me think a lot, and appreciate even more the career that I had, and thank you for taking me down that lane.
Thank you so much.